I'm David Martin Davies, and coming up on The Source, Joan Crawford was a Hollywood icon with a five-decade career that mirrored the evolution of American cinema and the shifting roles of women in society. But long before Crawford won an Oscar for Mildred Pierce, she was Lucille LeSueur, a baby born in a San Antonio shack. But she refused to remain poor and unnoticed. Crawford's life was a testament to her relentless drive for self-invention. She went from a childhood of profound poverty to the zenith of global stardom and business success. She also became a controversial figure from her daughter's tell-all, Mommy Dearest. The story is told in a new biography, Joan Crawford, A Woman's Face. We'll hear from the author, Scott Eyman. That's what's coming up on The Source, but first, this news.
Support for The Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at uthealthsa.org.
From the John L. Santico Studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. She was one of Hollywood's brightest and most controversial stars, but before Joan Crawford was an Oscar-winning actress, she was Lucille LeSueur, born in a shack in San Antonio. A new biography, Joan Crawford, A Woman's Face, author Scott Eyman dives into the story of this Hollywood legend. And Scott Eyman, welcome to The Source.
Oh, good to be here.
Well, of course, I'm attracted to the story because we're based in San Antonio, and she has been said to have been born in San Antonio, although that is kind of up for debate. So what is it? Was she born in San Antonio, and under what sort of circumstances?
Well, there is no birth certificate for Lucille LeSueur in San Antonio. There is no birth certificate for Lucille LeSueur in any of the outlying towns around San Antonio. We did a fairly thorough search through all the areas extending in hundreds of miles in every direction, checking for Lucille LeSueur, and there is no birth certificate. So there's no reason for her to lie about having been born in San Antonio. She did fib about her birth date, which she said was 1908. But in the 1910 census, which is the first time she actually shows up, where she's living in Lawton, Oklahoma, she's listed as being 5 years old. So we can assume with some degree of certainty that she was born in 1905, not 1908, because it was normal for actors and actresses in that era to shave a few years off their age, to buy themselves a little bit more time in the full flush of their careers. As to where she was born, I'm inclined to think she was probably born in San Antonio, because why pick out San Antonio out of a name out of a hat if you weren't born there? But in my research, I discovered that fully 20% of Texas births didn't have birth certificates pulled for them, probably because they were born at home without the intervention of a doctor or even a midwife who actually had the responsibility of filing birth certificates. That's my theory, but it's only a theory. It awaits final proof. So that's a long answer to a short question.
And in a shack, is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, it's a fair assessment. The LeSueur family, her father departed the family premises either just before or just after she was born. It was her mother's second marriage. Her first husband had died. Her first child by the first husband had also died. She remarried 8 days after her first husband died. So we have to assume that there was something going on in terms of a prior relationship. Marriages seldom happen in 8 days. Lucille had a brother who was also born in Texas. And there is a birth certificate. He was born in Bexar County.
Bexar County.
I'm sorry. But there is a birth certificate for him in 1903. So why there should be a birth certificate for her brother and not for Lucille is simply an open question.
So I would imagine that there's nothing special about Lucille LeSueur entering into this earthly plane that would have made her seem destined for Hollywood greatness.
No, nothing at all. Her father was a plasterer. Her mother was the daughter of a Salvation Army a general. So there was no money to speak of, and there never was any money to speak of as long as Lucille was living within the family. It was a very, very hand-to-mouth existence for the most part. Then they bounced around between Texas and Oklahoma and for some years, and then other areas around in the general geographic vicinity until they relocated to Kansas City in the early 1920s.
What was it about this very humble beginnings that eventually created the personality, a force of personality of Joan Crawford?
The desperate need to get out of that humble beginning. From the very early age, I think she felt constrained. She was never close with her brother. She was never particularly close with her mother. My theory is that she resented her mother for basically bringing her into the world in a situation that her mother was unable to better. Her mother, when she actually left her mother, and when they were in Kansas City, her mother was working in a laundry, managing a laundry. It's a little bit vague whether she was in a management position, but it was a laundry. And there were a few uncles that passed through along the way, as well as another marriage. Her mom was married three times that we know of. So it was a rough hand-to-mouth existence, lower middle class on their best day, and probably beneath that realistically. And she was never close, as I said, with her brother or her father or her mother. She met her father precisely once in 1934 when she was already a movie star. He wrote her a letter. She sent him a check, and he showed up at Culver City in the MGM studios. Some pictures were taken of them together, and then he left and she never saw him again. He died a few years later. She sent a check for $588 to the town where he died and paid for his funeral, and she did not attend. So her family ties were, shall we say, indistinct.
Yeah, and so she grew up with this attitude, as God is my witness, I'll never be hungry again?
Pretty much, yeah. As a matter of fact, she was up for the part of Scarlett O'Hara for about 15 minutes. But she didn't get it, and it's probably worked out for the best. It was probably a little too close to her life for her to have any objectivity about the part.
But she liked dancing. She took to dancing.
Her ambition was never to be an actress. That acting was an accident. She wanted to be a dancer. Dancing was her passion. Dancing freed her. When she danced, she was free. She could leave all the grief and anger about her beginnings behind and just exist in the moment. And she was working, she worked as a chorus girl in the Midwest, starting in Kansas, around Kansas and Oklahoma, and working up to Chicago. She was working out of Chicago in a troupe that was working in Detroit when she got lucky. The Schuberts were trying out a show out of town before it went into New York, starring Miss Dinguette, who was a very famous French chanteuse of the period, and the lover of Maurice Chevalier, incidentally. And a couple of chorus girls dropped out, and they needed to get a couple of chorus girls into the show while they were in Detroit before they went into New York. So they went to see this a show that she was in, and the stage manager and an actor named Jack Oakey, who became a comedian in the movies, picked out a couple of the girls. One of them was Lucille, and they signed her up and they took her to New York, which was certainly something she hadn't expected. Mm-hmm. And she worked for the Schuberts for the next year. She worked for the Schuberts for the year 1924 in a couple different shows. And at the end of 1924, she nabbed a screen test. And a lot of chorus girls would get screen tests as a matter of course,
right?
Because they were pretty, they had good figures, and if they could attract the audience's eye on stage, there was a chance that they could photograph.
Yeah.
So a lot of them got screen tests. Lucille got a screen test, and it turned out she photographed well. So MGM offered her a $75 a week starter contract, which was $30 more than she was making for the Schuberts.
Wow.
So she, in January 1925, she went to MGM, and that was the first time she'd ever really given serious thought to acting.
We're speaking with Scott Eyman. His new biography is of Joan Crawford, A Woman's Face. More on The Source right after this.
Support for TPR comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' compensation provider committed to helping Texas communities and emphasizing safety. More at texasmutual.com/texansgetit.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. For nearly five decades, Joan Crawford captivated audiences from the silent era to the 1960s in roles that defined a grit and glamour of the America cinema. We're speaking with Scott Eyman. He has written multiple books of Hollywood celebrities or legends, and his latest one is Joan Crawford, A Woman's Face. A Woman's Face is a film that Joan Crawford made about a woman who was disfigured, and Joan played a woman who was very unlikable, very mean. Why would you name the book after this particular film?
Well, it's about a woman. The film is about a woman who's terribly scarred by a childhood accident. Her face is disfigured. And it's, I think, one of the best things she ever did. What might be her best performance. It's not her most famous film, and it's not her most famous performance, but it's a remarkably good film up until the last 10 minutes, and a remarkably good performance. And it struck me that the whole premise of the film is a metaphor for her life, in terms of acting being a means of escape, and having to assume an identity that was a creation partially of her own need to get away from which the identity she was actually born with, and the studio's need to create a star for the investment they gradually assumed, and when they saw what they had after it. And it took, she was not a star immediately. Nothing much happened for basically a year. They put her in a couple pictures, used her sometimes as a photograph of somebody in a movie, other time, but they hadn't found her look. And her hair is marcelled, and it's not flattering. And also, she's heavier than she was. She weighed about 140 pounds when she got to MGM, and she was 5'4". And it was suggested by a cameraman named John Arnold that she dropped some weight. So she dropped about 25 pounds. And it popped out her cheekbones and made her eyes look larger. And her eyes were her best feature. She had extraordinarily beautiful blue eyes. And it really did improve her looks. The studio said, oh, well, maybe we've got something here. They worked on her makeup. They worked on her hair. And they sculpted. It was a co-production between Joan. They changed her name to Joan Crawford because Lucille LeSueur is a mouthful.
And they said sounded like sewer, like the sewer.
Yeah, yeah. And she didn't like Joan Crawford either because it sounded like crawfish to her. But she was going along to get along. You know, she liked Crawford better than she liked LeSueur, even if she didn't like Crawford that much. So they sculpted her, they changed her, and she learned and she watched everybody because she'd never acted before. So she paid close attention to the people that were acting at MGM. And the people that were acting at MGM included Greta Garbo and John Gilbert and Eleanor Boardman and Lon Chaney. And finally, she got cast in a film opposite Lon Chaney, and it was a revelatory experience for her because she'd never worked with an actor with that level of focus and concentration. And as she said, Lon Chaney showed me the difference between standing in front of a camera and acting. And she said, everything I learned about acting, I learned from Lon Chaney.
So this is the film The Unknown.
The Unknown, exactly.
And it is a silent film. It's a feature-length silent film. It's available mm-hmm. to watch on YouTube. And mm-hmm. I watched it, and I was amazed at how captivating. You know, I watched the whole thing. I figured it wouldn't hold my attention. Right. And it was just great. An amazing story. Armless, knife-throwing murderer is right. Lon Chaney, and he just way he is comes through this pops through the screen even today, and mm-hmm. she just watched him and absorbed that and saw how he emoted even without sound.
Yes, and the interesting thing is there's really not a part there. She's the girl, She's the girl he falls in love with. She doesn't really have much to do. But when they're in a scene together, your eye actually goes to her. And she's working opposite Lon Chaney, who is a hellaciously good actor and very charismatic. And she's got that thing you can't buy. She's charismatic and she's beautiful, but there's a lot of beautiful people that aren't particularly interesting. She's beautiful and interesting.
The name thing, Joan Crawford, it came from a movie magazine contest. They named the star.
And
exactly. So what's interesting about that is how Crawford is a self-created work of art in and of herself. It's, she was engineered, her face, her body, her screen persona, even her name, everything about her was basically a reflection of what of people who went to the movies wanted.
Exactly. Well, not exactly, because you couldn't, MGM signed up dozens of people for those starter contracts, those $75 a week starter contracts. They were 6-month contracts and all the options were on the studio side. Most of them washed out. 75%, maybe higher percentage, washed out. Because when you photograph them, when you put them in a scene, there was nothing there. They weren't interesting. But the ones that hit paid off and paid off all the money they spent on all the ones that didn't pay off. And Crawford hit big. And in 1927, with the Chaney film, she makes a splash. And a year after that, they started designing films around her. She made a film called Our Dancing Daughters, where she plays a kind of F. Scott Fitzgerald girl.
Like a who flapper.
She lives a short, exuberant life, dancing on tabletops and flirting with boys and drinking champagne, you know?
So let me just say, for people who, why a flapper was a big deal at the time, because it was the first time that we had this female expression of freedom and sexuality.
Exactly. Public expression of freedom and sexuality. The shirts, the skirts were short. The blouses were cut low. The makeup was forceful, shall we say. And the hairstyles were au courant. Yeah, it was not, we were not in the Victorian or Edwardian eras anymore.
And so she embodied that. She was, even F. Scott Fitzgerald said she was the flapper of his.
Exactly. The female avatar of the jazz age, basically. And the film was a huge, huge hit. And at that point, she's been in the movies for 2.5 years. And suddenly she's one of the biggest stars on the MGM lot. And she stayed that way basically for the next dozen years.
But what's interesting, though, she had this successful personality, this expectation of who Joan Crawford was and what she brought to the films. And then everything changed.
Well, gradually over time.
Well, of course, we had the talkies. That changed
pretty
quickly.
Sure. Sound rolls in 1927, 28. 1929, she makes her first talkie. Her voice is excellent. They try her in musicals because she loves to dance. And she can get through a song, but she's not really a singer. And she's not a great dancer, but she loved to dance. But, you know, Ginger Rogers, she wasn't. So she basically stays a dramatic actress. And she gets better and better. And a lot of her magnetism is amplified by the right leading man. You know, it's hard to be enticing when you're working opposite, you know, a wet handkerchief. But when they paired her with the young Clark Gable in 1931 and 32, they really struck sparks off screen as well as on screen. And they made 6-7 pictures together. And their pictures of the early 30s are really, really interesting. And because they're both born stars and they're pretty good actors, even at that stage, but they are born movie stars. But when you put the two of them together, it's like nuclear fission.
So the jazz age ended, the Depression era began, and what Joan Crawford kind of roles she was going to play also changed with that.
Well, what you find This is the beginning. What Crawford did, and I think it was predominantly unintentional. It started out as unintentional. It was just a question of, she was in sync with her own generation of women. So what she did, beginning with the Flapper movies in 1927 and 28, she essentially mirrors her audience. And she continues to mirror her audience through the 30s and into the 40s. The Flapper thing kind of comes to a crashing halt with the Depression and the stock market crash. So what suddenly the water is at everybody's chin and just survival is a task. And she begins playing those roles. Poor girls trying to make a go of it, who don't have a lot of education, who don't have a lot of status, who don't have a lot of leverage. What they've got is drive and good looks. In other words, she's playing variations on herself. But that variation on Joan Crawford resonated strongly with all the other young women of her generation that were going through exactly the same thing in the real world. So her box office got richer and richer and richer.
She, Joan Crawford is also defined by her rivalries that she had with other stars, and one particular stands out is the aristocratic and elegant of Norma Shearer. Why were they rivals?
Well, Norma Shearer was married to Irving Thalberg, who was the production head at MGM. And Norma Shearer got first pick of properties at the studio because she was the boss's wife, basically. And Crawford basically developed a serious problem with Norma Shearer because she felt it was unfair advantage, taking unfair advantage. And as she said to Louis B. Mayer, who was the president of MGM, Irving takes care of Norma and William Randolph Hearst takes care of Marion Davies, but who's going to take care of me? And there was really no answer to the question because there was nobody else at MGM as powerful as Irving Thalberg and William Randolph Hearst, except Louis B. Mayer, and Louis B. Mayer rarely messed around with the talent, so he wasn't going to be able to help.
So didn't she take care of herself? I mean, she fought for roles. How did she do that?
Well, you basically dazzle them. You keep them Crawford conscious. You find out what scripts are going into production, who the producer is, and you go in and you talk to the producer about this part that you read in the script, and you get aggressive. You don't wait for them to come to you. You go to them. And it was a difficult issue because she's competing not just with Norma Shearer, she's competing with Garbo, who's in a kind of special category. They wouldn't be up for the same parts, but she's competing with Jean Harlow. The place was stock full of actresses, but the only one she had a real problem with was Norma Shearer because she felt Shearer took unfair advantage.
So what happened during the film A Grand Hotel, 1932?
Well, that was the deep end of the pool. Suddenly they put her up against John Barrymore, Greta Garbo, Wallace Beery, Lewis Stone. It's chock full of good. Well, Wallace Beery's not a good actor. But we'll leave him out of it. Lionel Barrymore's not a good actor. But Lewis Stone and John Barrymore and there were some other good actors in the picture. She's on a fast track. And there were a lot of people thought she wasn't going to be able to keep up, because she's working. And Greta Garbo is a great actress and John Barrymore is a great actor. And they thought, well, here's this little, poor little girl from Texas, Oklahoma. She's going to get wiped out. And she didn't get wiped out. She's basically the best thing in the picture. And she gives a very believable, lifelike, moving performance.
Of a homewrecker.
Well, no, she's not a homewrecker. She's doing what she has to do in order to survive.
So you see that San Antonio Shack energy coming up.
Oh yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Sexual energy. She had Crawford always had sexual energy.
All right, we're talking about the life of Joan Crawford, a new biography out on her, Joan Crawford, A Woman's Face. Author Scott Iman is with us. He has written multiple biographies of Hollywood legends, and we're going to continue discussing Joan Crawford, what made her special, a legend, how she should be remembered today when we come back from this break. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Stay with us.
A donation comes in many forms: a sustaining membership, a one-time gift, even a home, land, or commercial property. Donating property is a great way to give back, and you may even claim a tax deduction. Get the process started today. Call 844-277-HOME or visit tpr.careasy.org/real-estate-donation.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Joan Crawford is a legendary Hollywood star, an Oscar winner for her film Mildred Pierce. But before she was that star, she was labeled box office poison. We're going to get facts about that from Scott Iman. He has written a new biography of Joan Crawford. It's called Joan Crawford, A Woman's Face. So Joan Crawford was riding high, making great films. But then, like happens to many in Hollywood, your career comes to a grinding halt and she gets labeled box office poison. What was that?
Well, she had a couple stiffs, basically. And also, she'd been around at this point for 16, 17 years. She was no longer the bright young thing. You know, everybody thought they had her pegged. And because MGM was a factory in the business of manufacturing movie stars, they brought in newer, younger actresses. So she was competing against Lana Turner, Hedy Lamarr, three or four others that were doing, you know, that seized the public's attention. And suddenly she was no longer the fair-haired girl at the studio. And she could see what was happening because she'd seen it happen to other actresses when she was the hot young thing at the studio. It's the nature of show business, you know? There's a constant churn. And once you get to a certain age, The problem was, is that in the era we're talking about, there was only the movies. There was no secondary place to go unless you wanted to go in the theater. And the theater is much harder work than making movies, and it didn't pay as well as the movies. So even though for actors that had come out of the theater and gone into the movies, they kind of wanted to stay in the movies. But there was no second tier. There was no streaming services where once you failed to attract audiences to a theater, you could still do work in streaming movies and make good money.
There wasn't even TV.
There wasn't television as a fallback. There was no fallback. When you were done, if the movies were done with you, you had a problem, you know, if you were an actor or a writer or a director.
So MGM buys her out and she leaves the studio. No big celebration, no flowers, nothing. She just drives off. But then she gets another contract at Warner Brothers, not as lucrative, but what happens?
No, well, for a year, nothing happens. She turns three or four scripts down. She's waiting for the right script, and they're sending her stuff with Bette Davis's fingerprints on it or Barbara Stanwyck's fingerprints on it. And she and Stanwyck were friends from the New York Chorus Girl days because Stanwyck was working for Ziegfeld as a chorus girl when Crawford was working for the Schuberts as a chorus girl, and they'd gotten to know each other, you know, in the after hours where the chorus girls would gather. And they stayed friends for the rest of their lives. But there was more commonality between Stanwyck's personality as an actress and Crawford's than there was between Stanwyck's and some of the other people that were, or Bette Davis, for instance. So she turned those scripts down, and Jack Warner was peeved, because he expected her to be obedient, you know, and she was not obedient. She was waiting for the right script. Finally, Jerry Wald, a producer at Warner's, got the idea of taking James M. Cain's novel, Mildred Pierce, adding a murder, because the novel didn't have a murder in it, adding a murder and making it a kind of bleak film noir woman's picture. The script came together gradually. There were like six or eight writers on it over time, including William Faulkner, and who ended up having nothing in the film. But finally, the script was done, and Crawford loved it and said she'd do it. And she got an Oscar for it, her Academy Award.
But she had to fight for it. They didn't just hand it to her. She had to audition.
She had to audition. That's right. They weren't sure. And stars don't audition. You know, character actors audition. Young actors audition. Movie stars don't audition. They're penciled in automatically. She had to audition. And she didn't mind. She realized that this was what she had to do to get it. You know, I think it was probably the last time she did audition, however.
So she got the part, wins the Oscar, but still, you know, she makes a few more films, but eventually her career runs out of gas, right?
Well, yeah, over time, it's the mid-50s. It's 10 years after Mildred Pierce. Her career starts to run out of gas. By this time, she's 50 years old. And that's always a difficult time for a leading actress, because you can't play the hot young thing anymore. You're playing mothers or possibly even grandmothers. And, you know, the audience is not necessarily interested in mother's problems or grandmother's problems. So there's a downshift that actresses have to do. And she wasn't crazy about that. And the alternative was television, which had come in a big way. But she never liked television particularly. She didn't trust it. It was hurry up and get it done, as opposed to movies, where they took time with photography and lighting and production. You know, it takes 8-10 weeks to shoot a movie. It takes 6-7 days to shoot a 1-hour TV show. There's a huge difference in approach in those two time frames. And she didn't trust television. And very few, and a lot of the people from the movie business who went into television struck out. You know, the only one I can think of two that would succeed in television. Loretta Young, who had a very successful show for 8 or 9 years, and Dick Powell, who had a very successful run as a producer in television in the 50s.
And there was this guy, Ronald Reagan, did okay there.
Yeah, but he was a front man. He was hired as an MC.
It somehow turned out good for him.
It worked out real well for him. He was treading water for a while until he got a better job down the road.
Yeah, down the road. So I don't understand. Why do it? Was she attracted to the money or the fame? What was the, why did she do what she did?
She wanted to work. Work was her self-image. Her image of herself was as a worker bee, you know? She wasn't someone who, she took it, that year she took off between MGM and Warner Brothers was like, in her memoir, she says it was 3 years. I did the math, it was a year. But it felt like 3 years, which is why she described it as 3 years. She was a worker bee. She's not a woman who wanted to sit around the house working on the flowers, you know? I mean, she could cook. She was a good Tex-Mex cook, as a matter of fact. She did Tex-Mex up to her last illness in her apartment in New York. That was her favorite cuisine. But it wasn't her identity. Her identity was as an actress. And she was sitting around twiddling her thumbs, waiting for the right thing. And at that point, she didn't know the right thing was going to come along. You don't know that the next script, the script that's going to come in next month is going to be great and perfect for you. You pray, you hope. But, you know, sitting around for a year after you walk out of MGM, that's got to be tough on the nerve system.
When she was older, she eventually made that film, Whatever Happened to Baby Jane, with Bette Davis.
Yep. And it was a huge hit, which nobody expected. It was made quickly, expeditiously. They had $900,000. Each of them had a percentage of the profits. They had 6 weeks to make it. The movie ran 2 hours and 10 minutes. So there was no time for anything but to get the picture done. You know, it was a sprint, not a stroll. And as Robert Aldrich, the director, said, it's proper to say they detested each other. But they acted perfectly. There was no cross words. There was no temperament. There was no time for temperament. They had to get the movie made on time. So they each cooperated with Aldrich, and it's a very, very good picture for both of them. And it was a big hit, and it propelled both of them into the last phases of their career. Davis lived a lot longer than Crawford did, however. So she had a longer third act than Crawford did.
And she used it to say a lot of mean things about Crawford.
Well, Davis didn't like Crawford at all, because there was a backstory there. Davis had a mad crush on Frank Chautauqua, who was Crawford's husband at the time, and made a hard play for him, but he was completely uninterested and blew her off because he was in love with Crawford. And Davis took that amiss. And then years later, Davis got nominated for an Oscar for Baby Jane. Crawford did not, but Crawford offered publicly to accept the Oscar for anybody that won the award that wasn't Betty Davis. So as it turned out, Anne Bancroft won the award for The Miracle Worker instead of Betty Davis, and Crawford got up and accepted it for her, and Davis took it as a personal affront, which in essence it was. And that only increased the bad blood between them.
Yeah, so Davis accused Crawford of, even if she had helped Betty Davis win the Academy Award and not campaigned against her, then they both would have made a lot more money with their percentage.
Theoretically. The film helped them both out financially, but it wasn't about money. It was about ego.
Betty Davis had the famous line about Joan Crawford that she slept with everyone in Hollywood except Lassie. Did she actually say that? Is it? And what is that?
It sounds like something Betty Davis would say. Not actually true, by the way. And Davis had no room to talk.
So Crawford, it makes it look like that Crawford slept her way to the top.
No, she didn't. Nobody could sleep their way to the top. You could sleep your way to a shot at the top, but nobody could sleep your way to the top because only the public keeps you at the top.
Why do you think that film still resonates, that Whatever Happened to Baby Jane?
Well, it's a good movie, for one thing. For another thing, it's a riff on Sunset Boulevard, two out of work, slightly deluded movie stars of the dim past who are locked in the house together, sniping at each other. You could do it on stage. It'd be a good play, actually. It had the impact it did because it's Betty Davis and Joan Crawford. You've got the two primary leading ladies of mid-century Hollywood going at it tooth and nail. You know, it's like Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf
on wheels,
for girls.
All right, Joan Crawford, A Woman's Face. I was speaking with the author, Scott Eyman. We're going to be back after this quick break. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies, speaking with Scott Eyman. He's written multiple biographies of Hollywood's biggest names. His latest one is Joan Crawford, A Woman's Face. Why did you decide to focus on Joan Crawford?
I got lucky. 10 or 11 years ago, I was finishing up a book on Cary Grant and tearing my hair out, what little hair I had. When I was on the Turner Classic Movies cruise as a guest, and Crawford's grandson was on the cruise, and he showed an hour of her home movies, 16mm Kodachrome home movies, and I was transfixed, absolutely transfixed, because there were a window into a Crawford I didn't, or nobody else knew existed. Her coloring, she had reddish brown hair, she had freckles, which you never saw on screen because they used pancake makeup to cover up her freckles. And what was striking about it was she's obviously in love with this other guy in the movies. And we did, at the time, we didn't know who it was. The movies were on a shelf in her apartment in aluminum cans wrapped with adhesive tape around them, on which she had written Charles and Me. And her grandson didn't know who Charles was. And after he showed the movies, he asked me if I knew. And I said, no, I don't know either. I said, he's not a director. There are some directors in Hollywood named Charles, but none of them are that guy. I know what they looked like. I said, he could be a producer, but what are they doing in the East? Because all the trees were bare of leaves. It was in the fall. And it's clearly fall. They're dressed, you know, in fairly heavy weather for 40, 50 degree weather. So it's not California. It's not Palm Springs. If you're going to have an affair with a producer, you just go to Palm Springs. You don't go all the way to... where Massachusetts, New York, wherever they were. As it turned out, they were in upstate New York. The the identity of Charles came accidentally. Casey, her grandson, was showing the home movies at Burbank Public Library. And one of the people in the audience came up and gave him some columns that Hedda Hopper had written. And one of the columns mentioned the number of actors that were being cast in the next Joan Crawford movie. This is 1940. And it was so-and-so, 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 and Charles McCabe. And Casey called me and he said, do you know an actor named Charles McCabe? I said, there was no actor in California named Charles McCabe. Let me look up the Broadway database. So I looked up the Broadway database. There was no Broadway actor named Charles McCabe. So I said, okay, let's do something district. Let's look at Wikipedia. And I looked up Wikipedia, and there was the guy in the home movies. Charles McCabe was the publisher of the New York Daily Mirror, which was the Hearst paper, Walter Winchell's home paper. And somewhere along the line, she had met Charles McCabe and had an affair with him, and they had traveled together at hunting lodges along the East Coast. As it turned out, the one they were at was in upstate New York. And you could tell it was 1939, 1940 by the cars on view. I could tell that when I saw the home movies the first time. It's 39 or 40. So Casey called, and Charles McCabe had died in 1972. Crawford had died in 1977. So he called one of Charles McCabe's sons, surviving sons, and mentioned he was Joan Crawford's grandson. The son said, oh, Joan Crawford. And he talked about when their father died, he and his brother had gone through their father's desk. And they found a stack of letters from Joan Crawford. And they read the letters, and the relationship was clear. Now, Crawford, in her memoir, mentioned a businessman that she had met after her divorce from Franchotone in the East, a businessman who took her to conventions and introduced her to his friends and his social circle, and they'd gone hunting together, but she never mentioned his name. So clearly it's the same guy. And she said that he had asked his wife for a divorce, but she wouldn't give it to him. So Casey asked McCabe's son if... his wife, his father had asked his mother for a divorce. He said, of course not. He had affairs all the time. He never wanted to get a divorce. It kept him from having to, you know, marry these other women. So all that, identifying the guy and the story behind the home movies, made me start thinking about Joan Crawford, because the movies revealed a Joan Crawford that never showed up in the movies she made as an actress.
Whole story sounds like a Joan Crawford film.
But if you saw her in the movie, she has an abandonment and an openness. She's dancing with her dachshund. In one shot, she's sunbathing in the nude. She's open in a way to the camera that she never was in Hollywood. But the thing of it is, because it's just a 16mm home movie, she still pops through the lens because she's got that face. She was born to be photographed. And the camera loves her, and she has no makeup on. She's just in street clothes, but the camera loves her, and she just pops through the lens. And it got me thinking about what we didn't know about Crawford, this guy, a very serious love affair that she managed to keep hidden all her life. And then also got me thinking about what we thought we knew about Crawford that maybe wasn't so. And so, but those two questions kind of acted on me. And I just finally put them into action and wrote the book.
So that part you said was she's sunbathing in the nude. Maybe this is the long-lost stag film that's been rumored that Joan Crawford made. I'm kidding, but
no,
what about that?
No. I talk about that in the book. Because the FBI got, for no absolutely no reason, got into the Joan Crawford business in the middle 1950s and started looking for the stag film. Because they had nothing else better to do, clearly. The mafia must not have been much of a problem at that point. But they started looking for the famous Joan Crawford stag film. And what they came back with was, well, we found a lot of people who say they've seen the stag film, but we can't find the stag film. It doesn't seem to exist. But there's all these people that say they've seen it. So my gut feeling is that, and Crawford said her way of addressing the issue was, I wouldn't have been that stupid. My feeling is there was probably a stag film of the 1920s with an actress who looked vaguely like Crawford in her chrysalis stage before MGM got her to lose the weight, you know, and it maybe she had blue eyes or something, and there was a resemblance, and an urban legend was born. That's my gut. But nobody's ever come up with even a frame of any kind of film that featured Joan Crawford. And I suspect if there was such a film, it would have appeared at some point.
Mommy Dearest, we got to tackle this. The book, the film Mommy Dearest, where they portray Joan Crawford as this abusive, adoptive mother. How much of that is true?
Well, it depends on who you ask. Her daughter, she adopted four children. Christina and Christopher swore it was true. Christina was the one who wrote the book. The twin daughters that she also adopted swore nothing like that remotely ever happened. So there's that. I talked to some friends of Crawford about who knew her as well, and whose parents knew her. The most I could get as confirmation was Eve Arden's son told me that his mother, who was a friend of Crawford's and who adopted three children following Crawford's example and the contacts Crawford gave her about adoption, thought there was some truth to the book. Everybody else came down the side of grossly overstated.
But she was tough, though, as an adopted mother. She wanted the kids to clean up after themselves, wash their dishes, basically her own coming up tough. She wanted to pass that along.
Well, I think it's fair to say that it seems strange from a modern perspective. It's as if she had no idea how a semi-normal, because who knows what's a normal family, but a semi-normal family, how a semi-normal family functions. And in fact, she hadn't had any idea how a semi-normal family functions, because she came out of a environment that was closer to Tobacco Road than a middle-class American family. It was not a semi-normal family in any way, shape, or form. So she placed probably overdue emphasis on proper behavior and decorum, more so than even most Hollywood families did.
So you've written major biographies of John Wayne, Cary Grant, Cecil B. DeMille, Mary Pickford, so many others. Where do you see Joan Crawford as her star power, her impact on popular culture? Where do you see she fitting with all those other stars that you have examined?
Near the top. She created an archetype. Her story has been replicated over and over again in the careers of other actresses who become stars, not so much because of where they want to go, but what they want to get away from. You know, and not everybody gets to the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art when they're 18 years old and 19 years old and has this wonderful family environment. If you read a lot of actors' autobiographies and biographies, more of them are trying to get the hell out of what they're born into than they are trying to get to Beverly Hills. That's a byproduct. Beverly Hills and Bel Air is a byproduct. It's not necessarily the goal. The goal is to get away. Crawford set that matrix up 100 years ago.
Would you want to hang out with Joan Crawford?
Oh, God, yes. Oh, God, yes. I'd love to talk to her because she was very honest and loved to dish. And
generous, very generous.
She was extremely philanthropic. The checkbook was always open for people she barely knew. I mean, she'd pay for appendectomies for publicists at MGM. She'd pay for voice lessons for an effeminate publicist at MGM who nobody took seriously because he talked like a sissy. So she paid for vocal coaching so he could, you know, talk in polite society and not have people snicker. Her checkbook was always open for people. She spent a lot of money on things she didn't have to spend money on.
So you think that she should be her reputation should be rehabilitated from the Mommy Dearest?
She was a lot more than my take on Mommy Dearest is basically she's portrayed as Cruella de Vil, this kind of whirlwind of rage when thwarted. But Cruella de Vil is a cartoon character. Joan Crawford was not a cartoon character. She was a larger than life woman who was 5'4". But when she came to the room, it was like she was 6'4". She had emotional size. She had great skill and talent as an actress. And she was, by and large, a very decent human being.
New biography, Joan Crawford, A Woman's Face, written by Scott Iman. Thank you so much, Scott, for talking to us today. Appreciate that.
Happy to do it.
That's it for this edition of The Source. I'm David Martin Davies. Thanks for listening.